Napa know-how.
A Napa guy knows more isn't always better, unless we're talking about full-size vans. These beasts do more than get you from A to B. They have so much space a man can live in it. With shag carpeting, waterbed, and a sweet lava lamp, these mobile abodes have all the comforts of home. With quality parts and plenty of Napa know-how, you can keep the original tiny house running longer, stronger. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. This is nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, in an interview in Management Today, my guest tonight, psychologist Dr. Tomas Chamorro Premusic, talked about the three biggest myths about confidence. The first myth, the higher the better. The second myth, we should all believe in ourselves no matter what others think of us. And the third myth, that exceptional achievers like Obama, Muhammad Ali, Madonna, and Oprah owe their success to confidence. In fact, he says what he calls the confidence cult, the notion that boosting our confidence will solve all our problems, has in fact made many of our problems worse. This often messes up our ability to find a romantic partner, to keep a job, to get promoted, and to live the happier and more satisfying life we could if we were a little more honest about ourselves and our abilities. Dr. Tomas Chamorro Premusic is with us tonight to help you achieve realistic confidence, what he calls confidence based on competence. He is a professor of business psychology at University College of London and an authority on personality assessment, consumer analytics, and talent management. His book, which we'll be discussing tonight, is Confidence, Overcoming Low Self-Esteem, Insecurity, and Self-Doubt. Hello, Tomas.
Hi, Amy.
Hi. Oh, thank you so much. I loved your book. It really is a breakthrough compared to just the flood of the confidence cult self-help. And so tell us, you know, about the claim that boosting confidence is the solution to all our problems. You say there are two big problems with that. And the first is that it's practically impossible to increase one's confidence without distorting reality.
Yes, absolutely. So number one, it's very difficult to do this. So when people try to deliberately boost their confidence, they almost only have one possibility, which is, you know, to distort reality. And either by thinking more highly of themselves than they actually should, or by distorting other people's perceptions of them. And a second problem is, of course, that this won't guarantee any success at all. Contrary to what most people think, boosting our confidence has very, very limited advantages. I guess there are only two real advantages. One is it feels good to think that we're great, even if we're deluded. And the second one is that this delusion can help us fool other people, but only in the short term.
Yeah, I think that's important. We'll get to that later. And one thing also that I like that you said in the beginning of the book when you're explaining this was that the illusion that high confidence can help us achieve anything puts a great deal of pressure on us to feel assertive and to translate that into success. And it makes people who lack this confidence actually feel guilty and ashamed.
Yes, so that's the consequence. The kind of feeling that people get after failing to deliberately boost their confidence, which is what happens to most people who are often, you know, perpetual consumers of self-help messages that try to help them or show them ways in which they can boost their confidence. Typically, people fail to do this, and then they feel guilty because they say they've almost experienced or think that the solution was within reach. and that it would have been very simple to solve their relationship, their career, their health problems by boosting their confidence. They haven't succeeded at it, and then they feel bad and guilty, and everything backfires.
Now, I love how you define confidence as feeling able and competence as being able. So talk about the difference.
Absolutely. There is a fundamental difference, and I think it's quite worrying that in almost every part of the world, but particularly Western society, if you could offer people a pill to either, I don't know, boost their talent, their IQ, their social skills, but if there was a confidence pill, most people would choose to take that one. And really, there is a fundamental difference between confidence and competence. I say confidence is how good you think you are, competence, how good you actually are. And although there are reasons why we might want to pursue or try to attain confidence, the end goal is actually to attain competence. And now, what I show in the book is that confidence most of the time doesn't help us reach that end goal. But still, everybody does agree and would agree that what we really want is to become more competent, not more confident.
And I liked in that interview you did with the Management Magazine, you said the word con, as in con man, comes from confidence. And a confidence trick is to pretend that you're somebody you're not, that you're giving a better deal than you are. And so you say, actually, that lower confidence is the key to gaining competence, which is kind of amazing.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I can relate that kind of that anecdote or that that part of the interview to my personal experience. I grew up mostly in Argentina and spent a lot of time in South America, where people are renowned for their social skills and their charisma and their charm, and they have this amazing ability to improvise solutions to everyday problems and take shortcuts. A lot of the times these shortcuts involve fooling other people, and we value a good con trick, and you know, we like the idea of being defined or described as con artists. But collectively, the implications of this ability are really negative. You know, if a nation or a society or a country that venerates and rewards people who fool and trick others is destined to failure, because really you end up not developing any real competence or any hard work at all. All you want is to take shortcuts and just, you know, kind of reward individuals for fooling other people.
And now this brings us to narcissism. You write about narcissism, which is, you say, a state of mind characterized by unrealistic feelings of grandiosity and inflated self-confidence. So explain grandiosity, because I don't know if everyone knows what that means.
Yeah, so it's kind of delusions of being a really important person. Some psychologists describe it or talk about need for uniqueness. And actually, this isn't just based on our own work. There's a psychologist called Twenge who published a very interesting and relevant book on narcissism, showing that over the past 50 or 60 years, people have been feeling more and more important, more and more special. So, for example, in studies in the 1930s or 1940s, only about 20% of high school students thought that they were destined for fame or glory, or that they will become a very important person in the future. Now the figure is more like 80 or 85%. And this is something that we can also see in the popularity of, you know, social media sites like Facebook, the fact that everybody on Facebook or Twitter can almost imitate or feel that they're having a celebrity-like experience, but uploading very, very you know, glamorous pictures of themselves, only sharing a positive status and so forth. So I think narcissism levels or this kind of unrealistically high levels of self-concept, feeling that we are much better and more special than everybody else, have been on the rise for decades, especially in the U.S.
Yeah, and so, and narcissism, this self-important, self-centered feeling, there's research by Roy Baumeister on this, But I feel, and you mentioned in the book, and you talk about some of his research, and some of his research is very good, but I took issue with his, he talked about prisoners. He said, well, they have high self-esteem, and look at them, you know, it doesn't get you anywhere. But I think that he actually took the work of Nathaniel Brandon, who's not an academic and was kind of snobby about him, and sort of conflated it with narcissism, where what Brandon says is very similar to what you say. Brandon says that self-esteem is feeling that you are competent to deal with what life throws you. And this doesn't mean that you're going to win all the time. In Brandon's regard, you can feel good about yourself if you lost, but if you feel I worked really hard and I played really well. And this dovetails with some of what you say, and talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that there are two important sides to narcissism. One, for sure, is this idea that it's characterized by very high levels of self-esteem, or if you want, self-concept, you know, thinking that you're great. Because self-esteem is how you feel about that and how that makes you feel. But for certain people who are more narcissistic tend to have really, really high and distorted levels of self-concept. But the second characteristic and feature they have is that these levels of self-concept are also very unstable. So they need permanent affirmation from others that, you know, to confirmation from others about their own greatness. And this makes them very likely to ignore negative feedback, to respond aggressively when somebody criticizes them, and they also become overly attentive to positive feedback, and they constantly seek approval from others. So those are the two things that more narcissistic people have. I think really the main problem for the impact that it has in society is the fact that too many people today, as a consequence of this, unnatural and kind of radical attempt of maintaining positive selfies, as a consequence of that, they have really high aspirations, but also very low work ethic. Because if you think that you're entitled to all these great things, then you probably won't work as hard to achieve them. You think you just deserve them.
Absolutely. And this is such a great message of your book. And I am talking with Dr. Tomas Chamorro Premusic, and his book is Confidence, Overcoming Low Self-Esteem, Insecurity, and Self-Doubt. And I laugh every time I read that, because one of the really great things about your book is that you talk about how we can benefit from insecurities and low confidence. And you say that low confidence is an adaptive tool. It can help you prevent disasters and enhance confidence. So talk about that a little bit.
Yes, you know, so many people have noted that kind of the subtitle of the book is almost in conflict with some of the message. In reality, you know, the book can work on two levels. On the one hand, it's designed or thought of as a monograph on confidence that tells people about, you know, the science of confidence, what we really know, what it really can do, and how it can be changed. But we also wanted it to work as a self-help book for people who have confidence problems. So in a way, the subtitle is if you want, a sort of catch, you know, to get people, to grab people who have this issue. But hopefully after even the first 30 or 40 pages, they start to understand that actually they're on the wrong mission. They shouldn't really worry too much about elevating their confidence levels. What they should do is try to become more competent in the areas of life that they need to. And what the point that the book makes is that really being aware of the fact that something is wrong, so having low confidence, being insecure, is a fundamentally adaptive threat detection signal. So something that actually tells them, from an evolutionary perspective, is something that tells them or signals a discrepancy between who they want to be and who they perceive that they are. And that gap, that's the gap between their confidence and their competence, and that gap shouldn't be closed by distorting reality or suddenly, you know, training ourselves to believe that we're great. It should be closed by hard work, dedication, and having purpose, you know, and strategic goals that actually make us more competent.
Yeah, and I love this about your book because a lot of people, the way it's an advice book and it talks about it, explains the studies behind things, because people who aren't that confident often feel really bad about it. They feel like they're losers for not being confident. And the stuff you say about how increasing your confidence through competence is the right way, and the things you say about how what we call negative emotions, these actually can be positive. I think that they give people a little bit of hope and make them feel a little bit better about themselves, not in a bad way. And actually talk about that. You, like psychiatrist and evolutionary psychologist Randy Nassi, argue that depression seems to serve an important psychological function. So feeling down after a poor performance can actually be a good thing, you say.
Absolutely. I mean, firstly, let's think about a concrete scenario. You know, simple things, not major life crisis or pathological or clinical levels of anxiety, but simple things like people who worry about not feeling confident for giving a presentation at work or pitching, for a kind of a work project, or maybe turning up for their driver's license test. The issue is not that they should feel more confident because that will improve their performance. On the contrary, they are probably aware of the fact that they are not able to perform at the level that they want. So what they should do, since they are aware of these limitations, is to work hard. And, you know, more often than not, people who tend to be dispositionally or who default to these kind of negative or pessimistic tendencies, more often than not, they tend to actually be overly critical and too self-harsh on themselves. So it's possible that if, instead of trying to eliminate or cancel their insecurities, they actually pay attention to them, more often than not, they will end up being exceptional achievers, because if they really care about something, they will work and prepare and try to develop competence to such a degree or extent that, you know, they would actually be better than they think they are, but others won't care that much about their own insecurities and confidence, you know, if they can perceive them. So I think the most important thing here is to understand that there are mostly two types of people in the world, those who feel overconfident and those who feel underconfident. Very few people are aware of what their abilities or actual competence levels are, but there are more advantages in being underconfident than overconfident. Certainly, in the long run, if you want to improve yourself, it helps to have more negative self-views, because if you care about something, you will try to do something about it.
I find that self-doubt, which I have a lot of, makes me a much better writer, because I always feel, oh, it's not good enough, it's not funny enough. And when you stop doing that, you become a hack. And I just wanted to get into something. It got a little lost. I mean, not lost, but you said this great little gem of a thing, basically that competence covers your insecurities. You can still be insecure, but if you do something, if you get to the point where you work hard enough to do it very well, people will not notice that you feel like you're breaking inside. And you gave this great example of the difference in your own teaching style, where, you know, you felt like kind of a hot shot when you just started and you would just stand in front of the class and freestyle your lecture. You said you were very confident in your ability to edutain, but that the students, they were all worried you weren't covering the topics, they'd have to cover them themselves. And so you changed your teaching style.
Yes, absolutely. So when I started teaching, I felt, after finishing my PhD, I felt, okay, now it's the beginning of a promising academic career. Finally, I have a chance to, stand in front of a class and lecture. And I really felt like a hot shot, that I could do it without much preparation, that I was naturally endowed for standing in front of a class and telling stories. And I had a lot of fun, and I really thought I was great. Some students, maybe quite a few of them, liked it because it was different from the usual, more dry and kind of serious and formal style of my fellow academics, who were also a lot older. But I think it's actually a problem and a limitation of the students themselves that they couldn't tell the difference. Well, some did, but a lot of them couldn't, between this guy who was clearly very confident but didn't really know what he was talking about, didn't care about covering the content or actually teaching. And you know, but some students did. And then, you know, in my own mind, I was really entertaining, very inspiring. And as years passed, I started to, you know, pay more attention to the feedback. And actually, nowadays, I'm probably less confident than I was back then. I prepare a lot more, but I would say that the delivery of my lectures or my classes is a lot better. And the same happens, by the way, when I speak to the media or appear on television. You know, in the beginning, I thought, well, great, this is great. I can just freestyle it and say whatever I want. And now I actually worry about what I'm going to say, and I try to rehearse, and I try to prepare as much as I can. It's probably a less enjoyable feeling for me, but the result is better. So it will it makes you more successful.
Yeah, oh, I'm absolutely with you. I'm always terrified when I'm on TV, just terrified that, oh, my God, how will I get this information out? And it makes me sort of digest it in a way people can understand it. And it takes more time. It's not as much fun as freestyling, but it really, really works. And you say this amazing thing, just to get into, because we're both talking about others' perceptions of us. This is the thing nobody says that you say in your book. And I'm talking with Dr. Tomas Chamorro Premusic, and his book is Confidence, Overcoming Low Self-Esteem, Insecurity, and Self-Doubt. And you say that we should care about others' perception of us, not take the common advice to ignore what others think of us. And you say this advice is packaged as this passport to freedom and success. Ignore what other people think of you. But actually, you don't get successful by ignoring others.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's probably as common cliche or popular advice as just believe in yourself and boost your confidence. The message that we shouldn't worry about what others think of us. You know, the important thing is that we believe in ourselves. And actually, people are permanently, almost always encouraged to just be themselves, which is a very difficult thing. You know, I wonder even what it means. I mean, it's actually, it's quite hard to do that because, you know, it's almost like it's such a philosophical or metaphysical quest, you know, to find yourself. Who is your real you anyway? So, but more importantly, you know, living in society, in civilized worlds means interacting with other people and caring about what they think of us. So it's very important, A, from a point of view of making it possible to interact with others and not behaving in a selfish, self-centered way, but actually caring about what others think, whether they are upset or not about how we behave, etc. And secondly, most importantly, from a psychological point of view for self, our identity, our true meaning, who we are, really depends on what other people think. So from a very, very early age or phase of human development, we learn about the world and about ourselves through others. It's our caregivers, our parents, our significant others that give us meaning through language. And this doesn't really change afterwards in early adulthood, or late adulthood. Still, you know, in order to find out about who we are, our meaning comes from others. If you want to know what you're good at, you need to seek feedback. If you want to know what you're weak at, you need to seek feedback. And that applies as much to relationships as it does to careers, friendships, and even health-related behaviors.
I wanted to bring something up about that. I think this is great advice that you need to get feedback, but I learned to be very careful to get advice from the right people. For example, on my writing, I write a newspaper column, and readers will sometimes write me and tell me, oh, you should have done this, you should have done that. And I only take literary advice on writing, you know, from people whose literary judgment and brains I respect, and that's a short list as far as my writing goes. And so I just ignore that as noise. And the same thing, you know, with health, the problem you talk later in the book about health information, it's very hard for people who don't have a science background to assess who puts out good science. So it can be really hard for people to know who is a proper critic for them, but I guess you can practice that at least out of the health realm and, you know, have trial and error and see if some person is going to be more expert than another at counseling you and has your best interest rather than some kind of malicious interest at heart.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the problem, and that happens to me as well, when I write a column or an article or a blog, it tends to generate a lot of reactions. And you can, very quickly, whether it's 10 or 100 people who comment, you have some that are really in favor and some who are really against. And, you know, it tends to polarize people. And if I worried about all the negative comments that I get, I mean, you know, I wouldn't sleep at night. At the same time, I try not to feel too good about the positive comments or the praises, because what happens with these things typically is that anything that is, for something to be relevant to people, it needs to tap into their core values. And typically, you know, things that are irrelevant are really congruent or incompatible with people's values. So I think, you know, it really depends what your goal is. If your goal is to persuade people that they're wrong, good luck. You know, it's a very difficult thing to do. And most people, I think, when they react in a really volatile or emotional way, they don't even read or follow your argument. They just think, okay, they're on the left or on the right, or they're pro or against this, so I either like them or dislike them. So they're a bit emotional. But I think when it comes to seeking feedback from others, you know, the most important thing is to do it from people who are honest, from people who you admire, from people who you rate. And it's quite interesting, actually, that people who tend to have lower confidence and be more insecure tend to also seek feedback from people who are more critical. It's almost like they don't want to hear good news. They want to hear bad news. And that, I think, is a fundamental advantage when it comes to improving as well. If I'm working on a lecture, a presentation, a talk, or I write an article, I don't want to send it to people who tell me, wow, this is great. I want to send it to people who say, you know, this isn't persuasive, you're not really making the point well, etc. And of course that upsets me when they do that, but it also helps me improve it. So, you know, yeah. I would say that you have to use your kind of moderate critics or honest friends for these things to keep things in check.
You actually touched on something where the criticism really hits a nerve. Now, I have somebody I pay to edit every piece of writing that goes out, and she, her job is to tell me I'm not funny and the science is bad and all this other stuff. You know, and when sometimes when someone tells you something and you think, oh, I did such a great job, and they say, oh, this is crap. I mean, they say it in more sort of less loaded terms and explain that in that moment you feel attacked, you feel bad, and your tendency is to go defensive. And so I try when I feel like that to let it sit for a while and say, okay, I understand what you're saying, and to sit on it. And often a day later, I'll realize she was right. But in that moment, you do want to defend your ego. And I think if you realize that, maybe you can avoid just lashing back, you know, when you should be trying to listen.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, if anything, to go back to what the majority of people do or what they at least aim for, just like most people are overconfident rather than underconfident, most people really just seek and spend a lot of time seeking positive feedback, and unfortunately they get it. So, you know, they only talk to their close friends or to people who will actually make them feel good and boost their egos. And that's a recipe for disaster when it comes to improving and keep gaining competence. If you think you're really great and you're as good as you want to be, what motivation do you have for working harder? What goals do you have? You know, you just become complacent and arrogant, and that's a problem.
Yeah, that is a great point. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm talking with Dr. Tomas Chamorro Premusic. His book is Confidence, Overcoming Low Self-Esteem, Insecurity, and Self-Doubt. And now you touched before on something I want to get back to, that we tend to think that our views of ourselves are more accurate than everybody else's, but this actually isn't true. You and Adrian Furnham have done research in this area, And so it's really pretty important to get this feedback because we have such distorted views, apparently, of ourselves.
Yes, absolutely. So, and other people have done a lot of studies. I mean, one of the most pervasive and well-established biases in human thought is the so-called better-than-average bias. You know, the fact that in almost any domain of competence, most people think that they're better, not just better, but actually much better than average. So you ask people, you know, whether they think that they are better drivers than average. And 80% of people would say yes. You ask people if they think they have a good sense of humor, and 90% of people would say that they have a great sense of humor, when in fact, how many people are really funny? 10%? And the same for creativity, for, you know, estimating your IQ, even your romantic or seduction powers, you know. So it's statistically impossible for most people to be better than average. Even when you tell people, and I have done this myself, when we explain the better than average bias to people, and you have a room of 50 people, and I say, you know, most people are biased, and these are different biases. How many of you, how many people in this room think that you are biased? Nobody raises their hands, you know, which is also statistically impossible. So there are various streams or realms of research, from social psychology to personality and educational sciences, show that people's self-perceptions are very inaccurate. And there's also very interesting studies, which we have done as well, trying to compare the accuracy of self-perceptions vis-a-vis other perceptions. So this is very simple. For example, you get a bunch of people and you get them to rate themselves on, let's say, on creativity, how creative they are. And then for each of these individuals, you can get three or four people who know them quite well. There can be their classmates or work colleagues or their bosses to describe how creative they are. And then you follow them for 6 months or 12 months, and you see, you actually look at their performance and see if they're writers, you know, how well they do in writing classes, or whether they publish books and so forth, if they're musicians, whether they win any awards for compositions or performance. Other people's perceptions of us are much more accurate in predicting how good we actually are and how good we will be over time than our own self-views. And the reason for that is that our own self-views are subject and are the target of wishful thinking, optimistic thinking. You know, it's, we know that it's psychologically healthy, or at least it feels good to have high self-views. But because of that, we become victims of, you know, our own distorted self-views, and we ignore other people's perceptions. So, and ultimately, the most important thing here is that we shouldn't be striving for high levels of self-belief. We should be striving for high levels of self-awareness. And I define self-awareness as the ability to know how other people see you. Because whether they are right or not, it really helps. It's consequential in everyday interactions to know what other people think of us. It will help you influence them. It will help you get along with them and so forth.
Yeah, I think that's so important. You bring this up time and time again about our inaccuracy at judging ourselves. And most people, you say, are inept at judging social skills, both their own social skills and others. And so this is stuff like whether somebody's lying and how popular they are.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, even experts do a really bad job at detecting or telling apart or distinguishing between truth and lies. And I think the baseline rate for detecting lies is something like 52%, so just 2% above chance.
Yeah.
So this is a problem, and I think, you know, you must know, Amy, in any domain of expertise or any professional domain of careers, there are just so many people in business who are charlatans and they don't know what they're talking about. But the reason that they are in business is that most of the time, more often than not, there are too many people, customers or in the audience, who cannot tell the difference between competence and confidence. So this happens, you know, particularly in managing and in the world of management, I have said this many, many times, I think one of the fundamental reasons for the very low representation of females vis-a-vis males in corporate management is the fact that even though they are as and often more competent than men, than their male counterparts, they're not as pushy. They're not as, you know, they're not as confident. So, and because people mistake confidence for competence, they would normally think that males are more leader-like and that they, you know, should be subordinates but not managers.
Yeah, and actually you talk about some things that top performers do better. And one is display confidence and the other is worked hard. You've talked about those. And then actually you note that be likable is the third. And you say that you talk about how arrogance never pays off but kindness does. People think that, like you were saying before, that it, you know, that arrogance and this sort of brash, I'm the rooster, confidence pays off. But you say that only does in the short term. And that getting along with others in the research seems to be a deciding factor in promotion to managerial roles and whether managers can lead an organization to success.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, I think it's intuitive to think that hardworking people do better. It's also intuitive to say that people who are more competent and talented do better. The problem is that most organizations and most, you know, companies and most jobs, people have very inaccurate and unreliable mechanisms for actually assessing or judging talent and hard work. You know, this is true for big, small organizations, private or public organizations. So the number one factor determining your career success, it's very simple. It's really whether your supervisor, boss, or direct line manager likes you or not. That's actually more important than whether you're working hard or whether you are talented, because those two things, how hard you work and how talented you are, most managers have very little data on this, and if they have it, they choose to ignore it. So what they look at is, do I like this person or not? And you know, it's needless to say that if you are perceived by your manager as somebody who is arrogant, somebody who undermines him or her, and somebody who is overconfident, that will work against you in your career. So, you know, it's a very dangerous thing to try to encourage people to be more confident at work when, you know, if your manager perceives what I call a confidence surplus, so that you're more confident than competent, that will work against you. And that's the same, by the way, in social relationships.
Well, that's a great way of putting that, more confident than competent. That's so important. And just to break in on that, you say something, because your book, Confidence Overcoming Low Self-Esteem, Insecurity, and Self-Doubt, you've also written it, it's an advice book. And so you say that you can boost your career confidence by boosting competence, because anything else will read as self-hype, because people do sometimes, you know, like you said, men, you know, some of these rooster men get promoted, but that people can often see through that it's just all talk.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, you know, thank you for making that point, because it is true that there are a lot of narcissistic, arrogant, and overconfident managers, CEOs, and bosses. And if you ask the average person to name how many great, nice bosses they ever had, it's unlikely that they would say more than two or three, you know. But that also tells us something about the state of affairs. If you look at, you know, data from employee engagement surveys, so year after year, big surveys or polls are conducted asking millions of employees around the world in all sorts of jobs how much they like their job, whether they're happy, engaged, energized, enthused at work. And consistently for the past 10 or 15 years, the findings are that only 30% of the people are actually engaged at work, so happy in their job. So that surely tells us something about how poorly they are managed. And actually, the number one reason for dissatisfaction is people's direct line manager or boss. So Yes, there are some arrogant, overconfident, and inept people who end up making it to the top. And actually, that's almost like a norm if we're looking at corporate, the corporate world and management in the corporate world. But that is only good for these individuals themselves, for the organizations, for productivity levels, economic prosperity, and society. It's a very, very bad thing. So I think that's why we have to be very careful with actually rewarding or fomenting the idea that we should just take shortcuts and be able to trick others into believing that we are competent when in fact we're not. Well, that doesn't really have any good long-term results for anybody else than you. And even for you, the results won't be very good.
Actually, and between the lines, I saw this advice from you, basically, that your advice to be likable, you know, is a way to be a top performer in your job, that's so important, to basically be a good guy who people can count on, who does their job well, but being likable is a form of competence. And that was reflected in a quote that you start a chapter with that I loved. It's from John D. Rockefeller, and he said, "The ability to deal with people is as purchasable a commodity as sugar or coffee. I will pay more for that ability than for any other under the sun." And if you're one of those people who's faking it in the office, who's actually a jerk and arrogant, you're not going to be one of those people who's able to deal with people. When he says people, I think it's probably he's talking about customers. And customers like people who are good, do their jobs well, and are likable.
Exactly. And those people tend to be or tend to have lower confidence than the average person. You know, so that's one of the fundamental advantages of being naturally more modest, naturally more insecure. You know, the less self-centered you are, the more you know, the more you kind of hesitate in thinking that you're great, the more insecure and less confident you are, the more likely you will be to pay attention to other people in a conversation, and the more likely you will be to care about others and about what they think. So these are natural advantages, despite the fact that we tend to think that people who seem really confident are charming and charismatic. The reality is that charisma is really just a politically correct word for arrogance, and that these people might be entertaining, but in the long run, you know, we really prefer people who are warm, kind, and modest.
Yeah, who engage with us on a real level. And you give this great advice. This is in your chapter on social confidence and people skills. I'm talking with Dr. Tomas Chamorro Primusic, and his book is Confidence, Overcoming Low Self-Esteem, Insecurity, and Self-Doubt. And you say in this chapter, this is on social confidence, that to improve your social competence, you need to learn how to read people. And this, by this you mean know what they want. And you talk about how we want love, to be appreciated and valued, success, which is status, to achieve our goals, and knowledge to understand the world. And that you need to know what people are going for in order to respond to them in some real way.
Yes, exactly. And I think, you know, what I was trying to do in that chapter is, I thought it's a kind of a potentially a very useful way of helping people who feel insecure and who question themselves and who have low confidence, because a lot of the times they will spend so much time ruminating and thinking about themselves and worrying about what other people might think of them. And what they need to understand is that in reality, most people just worry about themselves too. So if they can make the switch and stop thinking and worrying about themselves and start thinking about other people, including what their insecurities might be and what motivates and what drives other people, they will be much more effective relating and communicating with others. And it will immediately make them more likable. You know, if you stop paying attention to yourself and start worrying about what other people might be interested in, you'll be an exception in the world, because everybody really tends to be naturally self-centered. And just, you know, if you listen to most conversations, is normally you have two individuals, there will be two conversations. People are talking about two different things. Each of these individuals is talking about what interests them themselves.
I love something from that last piece of advice you gave. Basically, it was don't worry about your own insecurities. Worry about other people's insecurities instead to get ahead. But it's really true because people just, they want other people to show that they care about them, even on a small social level. And I really think your chapter is so focused on this. This is your chapter on social confidence and people skills, which so many people, I mean, I have a problem with that. And you give this great advice in there, ways to influence others. And it's all very focused on the other person. And you say, for example, not to argue, that the only way to win an argument is to avoid it. People don't want to be proven wrong. They don't want to lose face and look like an idiot. And if you just realize that, I mean, we're all pretty much the same, another bit of advice you say is when you're wrong, admit it. And I love this. Probably you say the best single best piece of advice regarding social skills ever given, give people a good reputation to live up to. And you say that you can influence people's identity, how they view themselves by shaping their reputations. And you give the example, tell a child he's a nice boy and he'll act accordingly. Tell him he's a bad boy and he'll misbehave.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, sometimes we hear people or you read that people say, especially about the relationships when they're in a very happy relationship, in love with somebody or happy about who they are with, they would say, you know, you make me want to be a better person. And that's such a nice thing to say. And it reflects the fact that, you know, that other person is making us feel that we could be better. You know, we know that they probably see us in an overly positive way, but that kind of gives us that reputation to live up to. And I think fundamentally, you know, the bottom line is of all these different suggestions or pieces of advice that I was giving in the chapter is that everybody wants to be appreciated. You know, if you're feeling insecure, if you have confidence problems, you're not alone. In fact, people who don't have this craving or desire for being appreciated are not normal, and they're probably really arrogant, very narcissistic, and megalomaniac. So actually, they have a bigger problem than you do. So fundamentally, at least when you're interacting with others, try to put your own insecurities aside. Don't worry about what you might think of yourself, and try to make them feel good about themselves. Give them a good reputation to live up to. That's really a very effective way.
Yeah, and actually, you touched on something. You have this great chapter on a loving relationship, and you talk about the Michelangelo illusion, which is the psychological process by which lovers and people dating bring out the best in each other. It's like the sculptor finding the best in the stone. And this is such a great view of love, your view of love, that are trying to bring out the best in each other. So talk a little bit about this.
Yeah, so the idea is that, you know, the Michelangelo illusion or principle is the idea that so lovers, just like the artist or Michelangelo, would see some potential beauty in another person as the artist or Michelangelo did when he was looking at a stone and could see the finished product or the statue already. I think this is really interesting and a very powerful metaphor for two reasons. One is that we need to understand that some people will always see us in a more positive way than others. So it's absolutely impossible to be liked by everybody, and it's unlikely that we are disliked by everybody too. So, you know, there will be somebody who will find us really attractive and who will have the potential to fall in love with us, whoever we are. And secondly, because it reminds us that actually love and relationship aren't a finished product. You know, we need to put something into it, and we need to actually, just like the sculpture, work to polish the product of the other person and the relationship into something that we really love. And in a way, the more work we put into it, the more we will end up loving it, because we invested so much into it, and it's the process that it's so enjoyable, not just the end result.
And you actually had this great thing. This is one of my favorite things from your book. You say, and I had a lot of them. You say that love is, in part, about finding someone who can help us reduce the perceived gap between who we are and who we want to be. And that's so great because people don't really understand. They think loving is just a feeling. Like, oh, I feel great. Well, we're, you know, butterflies and flowers. But finding someone who can help us reduce the perceived gap between who we are and who we want to be, I mean, that's so great.
Absolutely. So just like in general, we should pay attention to what other people think of us. That's even more important and fundamental with romantic relationships. So the ideal partner is a person who, you know, when they reflect our own image back to us, they almost make us happy with what we see, you know. And when they're not very happy and the feedback is not good, or they're alerting us that there are some problems that we need to change, if it's a true and strong relationship, we will understand that, you know, that's a fair point that we need to work to improve as well. So I think it's very important. You know, one of the most underrated functions of love and intimate or romantic relationships is how they shape our self-perceptions.
I really agree with you. Now, there's a problem because getting into the situation, because you say that the single most common cause of problems in people with relationship issues is a lack of self-awareness, that they're either unaware of how their behavior affects others, for example, their partners, or they're unaware of how desirable or undesirable they may be others, and they have distorted views that lead them to being perhaps with the wrong person.
Yes, absolutely. And I think on that last point, you know, I've researched the issue of romantic relationships for many years. I worked on projects involving, you know, TV shows on romantic compatibility, online dating sites, and I think fundamentally people are single mainly because of two reasons: either they are aiming too high or they're aiming too low. And when they're aiming too low, they might be in a relationship, but they tend to go from one relationship to another, or if they stay in a relationship, they're dissatisfied. And when they're aiming too high, they stay single for many, many years. Both things can be corrected if they improve their self-awareness and if they have a better understanding of how other people see them. And if they're not happy with those views by other people, well, then that's a very good incentive to changing the way they are, so that other people's perceptions can change as well.
See, I would add in, you know, and I think maybe this is even bigger, but that unresolved issues would be a bigger problem than the other two, or right up there. And actually, and you get into something which I deemed romantic overconfidence, and it's that this thought that finding the right partner guarantees a perfect relationship. It's that idea that love will solve everything. And so that sort of, you see that romantic overconfidence, that people can be overconfident in so many ways, and just every kind seems damaging.
Absolutely. And I would say, you know, we have 6 or 7 billion people in the world. Let's say that half of them roughly are adults or in active mating or dating age. And now, what is the statistical probability of anybody finding their ideal match? If there is one person, and if there isn't one person, because that person might be in the U.S., in Brazil, in China, in India, then how many are there? 100? 1,000? 1,000,000? You know, there's probably 50 million people who are compatible with you. So it's not about finding the right person and then, you know, thinking or hoping that that's it. Your problems are solved, you can focus on other domains of life and worry about work or whatever. No, it's about finding somebody who is more or less suitable and then working to make that relationship perfect or as good as you can.
Yeah, that's a realistic view. And I think of something, I call it your minimums, that you have to just figure out what your minimums are, the stuff you can't live without. And these can include physical attributes, like if the person has to be blonde or taller than you. But you have to realize that every time the list gets longer, you're narrowing down those people. And if, you know, 49 of the 50 people live in China, you have a problem if you live in Idaho. So this idea, and you talk about this, that you have to find similarity in a partner You know, this it's very unrealistic to think that you're going to find your perfect match.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the problems is that people, if you ask them what their kind of a wish list is or what their key priorities are, I mean, they come up with things that are just not really necessary or even relevant for long-term romantic success or even satisfaction, however you measure success, you know, but they either satisfaction. So there's a very big difference between what people want and what they really need. Compatibility is different from similarity. That's the thing. It's that, oh, you know, I am like this, therefore I need to be with somebody who is like me. More often than not, you need somebody who is different but compatible.
Yeah, you just reminded me, actually, I want to get to the thing I was thinking of getting to a little bit later, but we're almost out of time. But you reminded me, I wanted to just read the line that I came up with when I was looking for a boyfriend like 11 years ago. Greg will be mortified, but he fits every one of these. So I made a little list in about a line, and it's that I was looking for a tall, evolved man of character who thinks for a living and cares about making a difference in the world. And that was it. You know, he didn't have to have green eyes. You know, he just couldn't be short. And then he had to do all these other things. And in those things, tall, evolved, thinks for a living. Thinks for a living means smart, curious, you know, creative. Those, there's shorthand in there. But, you know, if someone has those attributes, they would be, you know, a good person for me. So like you said, you know, that there are many people that you're probably compatible with, but you have to have this realistic parameter that you create for them and not this, you know, grocery list.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. Keep your options fairly open. And I would say that when you're thinking about the constraints or those parameters or the boxes, it's more relevant to think of what you don't want than what you want. So leave as many options open for what you could want or have, but then be clear about what you don't want, because normally people are right about that. So, you know, if they don't want somebody who is very right-wing and their political views, you know, they're probably right. If they are vegetarian and they don't want to be with a meat eater, they're probably right, and so forth.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I came up with my list that way. I live in Los Angeles and gone out with a bunch of creeps, and I thought, God, I have to have someone ethical. And so that was how I got to my list. Now, I want to talk to you because about this. You said that there is a time to fake dating confidence. So there is a time to fake confidence and when you're dating, and when would that be?
So I think in the beginning, you know, I talk about initial dates or romantic encounters are very similar to job interviews, you know, where you have to present yourself in a natural way, but like you are on a very good day. So I think just like when anybody sees somebody being interviewed for a job or looks at their CV, they expect them to exaggerate a little bit or at least not to be overly negative and self-critical. So there is no point in revealing your insecurities or talking about negative aspects of yourself, let's say in the first 2 or 3 weeks of a relationship. That will come later on. I think, you know, there's a time to focus on positive things. There's more importantly, there's a time to focus on the other person, and that should be in the beginning. And you know, when it comes to dating, it's quite interesting because it's an area of life where it's more difficult and probably more subjective to distinguish between competence and confidence. You know, you don't really know how, let's say, good a partner, a romantic partner or a lover somebody is until you actually, you know, really into the relationship and you have been dating that person for, let's say, months, sometimes even years, you know, because there are certain things that show later on. So I think it does help when you want to attract somebody to portray yourself in a way, I wouldn't say overly confident, but if you can hide your insecurities when you're interacting with a person, change the conversation, focus on what you like, on what you know, on what you're interested in, that would probably make you more successful. And after a while, then, you know, you can start revealing the other things about yourself and talk about, you know, it's quite charming, actually. It's quite humbling in terms of when it comes to relationship, to talk about your insecurities and confidence once you, the person has decided that they like you already, because they will
right.
want to protect you and make you feel better. So that can come later on, not in the beginning.
Right, not that you're a loser on the first date. So we're almost out of time. I wanted to just go back to the head of the show. You talked about how confidence leads to confidence. That's a substantial way to do it. And at the end of the book, you quote Paul Arden, who is a former big ad agency creative director, and he says this very important thing that typically we say we want something, and we actually mean that we want to have it, but that with no implicit assumption that we're doing willing to do any work to get there. And this is what you say about all this sort of the low confidence people, that they feel bad, so they work harder. So it's actually better and more realistic to be like that. So if you can just give us a final word of advice on that, on how the low confident people can win.
Yes, absolutely. So I love that Arden, Paul Arden quote. You know, it's just, he says, "I want something means I'm willing to do what it takes to achieve it." And I think that's a fundamental message. You know, if you really want something, if you're desperate to achieve a goal, you really have no excuse in worrying about how confident you are. And in fact, it's an advantage to feel less confident, because then you know that you have to work really hard to achieve what you want. So whether that's a relationship, being healthier, losing weight, quitting your addictions, or improving your career success, having a certain job, it's not about confidence. It's about drive, determination, and really being motivated or having the willpower to achieve something. So desperately wanting something is key to achieving it. And if you're less confident of achieving that, that's even better, because you work harder to achieve it.
Oh, that's so fantastic. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. I've been talking with Dr. Tomas Chamorro-Kinruzic. His book is Confidence, Overcoming Low Self-Esteem, Insecurity, and Self-Doubt. Tomas, thank you so much. This has just been a great show.
Thank you very much.
I switched a lot of things in my life, but it's never worked out. I switched to being a vegetarian, but ate more bacon than ever. Every time I switch lines at the grocery store, I never pick the fast one. But one thing that totally worked out is I switched to Metro PCS and got a free Samsung Galaxy.
Make the right switch too. Move to Metro PCS and get a free Samsung Galaxy J7 with a huge 5.5-inch screen. Metro PCS. Wireless. Figured out.
Coverage not available in some areas. Plus sales tax. Excludes numbers on the T-Mobile network. See store for details, terms and conditions.